Last month, Ariel Sharon told the Israeli daily Yadiyot Ahronot that the present U.S. military involvement in Iraq should not shield Iran from the necessary strikes against its alleged nuclear facilities. The meaning is very clear. The U.S. is involved in Iraq, we know that, but there is someone to do it, and that is we. The Israelis will do it. All we're looking for is some sort of a green light from Washington, and that might not even be absolutely necessary. A yellow light would do. Also, at the regional level, there is a role for Israel, which I think that I wouldn't put you through the process of talking about it. I'm sure a lot of the Israeli urgings and contributions to this war are well known to all of you. But there is considerable evidence, really, that this was a war that Israel, that the Israeli generals, the Israeli media, the Israeli think tanks have been urging for quite some time. But I do want to, however, share with you a comment from an American who is very, very close to and high up, really, in the establishment, who put it quite clearly that this was Israel's war. His name is Philip Zelikow. Some of you might have come across the name Philip Zelikow. He's executive director of the commission entrusted with investigating 9/11. I mean, how high up can you be in the security establishment? He told an audience at the University of Virginia on September 10, 2002, that the war would be launched for Israel's sake because Saddam did not present a threat to the United States. By the way, Zelikow is not pro-Arab, he's not anti-Israel. He was simply telling the truth as he believed it. Most importantly, the war was to facilitate a settlement of the Arab-Israeli conflict and to end the whole Palestine question on terms wholly agreeable to General Sharon. Sharon's so-called disengagement, his unilateral disengagement, would assure an open sky prison in Gaza, while the apartheid wall would consolidate the colonial settlements and fragment the West Bank, ruling out a contiguous Palestinian state for some time to come. It aims to terminate the 1948 chapter in Sharon's own words. That's how Sharon put it, that the intent is to end the 1948 war. The 1948 war may be called by Israel's, by Israelis as Israel's war of independence, but what it really means to many Israelis and Palestinians is that it was the war of ethnic cleansing. So when Sharon said that the intent is to finish the chapter of 1948, he meant that it's too bad that we didn't go all the way in 48, but maybe Iraq will give us an opportunity to do that. I think it is very clear. He's not that subtle anyway. As I begin to conclude, and I'm not concluding now, I think I still have some time, but as I begin to think about concluding, let me say that the U.S. has not only been fighting its own war of hegemony, but also has been fighting Israel's as well. During the late 1980s and 1990s, America's policy objectives regarding Iraq was to prevent Saddam from presenting a model to replace the Gulf monarchies. He tried to avoid chaos and instability in Iraq that would invite further violence and interruption of the flow of oil. But while America's objectives have not been realized, it seems to me that Israel's objectives are doing better, at least in the short term. I must emphasize that the attempted remapping on the regional scale was absent from the strategy of the president's father when he invaded Iraq in 1991. The strategy did include, however, crippling the capacity of Iraq, the state, not the regime, but the state. That's really what bedeviled Bush I. Iraq was a state in possession of what it really takes to make it a target of U.S. colonial invasion. And what is that? It had three things, basically. It had superior human resources, highly educated population, that is. It had the second largest oil reserves in the world, not just had, but has. It also had plentiful water supplies. There is another ingredient, a fourth one, if you will. It had a leadership, though not very bright, having courted disaster, but one that refused to submit to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. A leadership which, despite its fascistic tendencies, rejected Washington's rules of the game, which others have accepted in the area, such as Egypt, Algeria, Yemen, Sudan, and as I was saying before, to some extent Syria, but Syria has not done it all the way. Now, the American, so Iraq has these implements, these ingredients, you see, which made it a candidate for the invasion. Hence, the two wars against Iraq in 1991 and in 2003, and the two wars in pursuit of two goals. These are two wars in pursuit of two goals. One of the goals is American, and the second goal is Israeli. The American goal was to prevent Saddam from setting the pace in the strategic Gulf in terms of oil production, in terms of oil pricing, in terms of marketing. Bush I wanted to establish that such a highly strategic endeavor could never belong to an ambitious third world leader such as Saddam, and must remain entrusted in the U.S. after the demise of the Soviet Union. That's why I think, I mean, briefly put, why Bush I went to war. That was the American objective. The second one of the wars, both wars, or let us talk about the first war first, is an Israeli objective. The Israeli objective, Bush I wanted to convince Tel Aviv that a crippled Iraq could not possibly threaten Israel. Hence, the time has come to head to the negotiating table to reach a long overdue political settlement based on a watered-down version of the two-state solution. In other words, Israel, you have no more excuses to talk about security. We've already, you know, smashed his head, and Iraq is no longer a threat to Israel. So let us go and rediscover and resurrect a version of Resolution 242. What happened? Well, in between Bush 1 and Bush 2, in between the two Bushes, Clinton and later the neoconservatives were able to steer Washington in totally different directions. Clinton had fallen prey to Israel's Oslo trap, a diplomatic facade which enabled Israel to foreclose on a territorial settlement based on the two-state option. And to elaborate on this, you need to look at that long interview by Dov Weisglass, the confidant of Sharon, in which he said clearly that the strategy right along has been to ensure that we never get to the negotiating table so that we wouldn't have to agree to a two-state solution. He put it very clearly, something that we knew all along, but it finally came out. Then what happens? Then enter the neoconservatives, who were enabled by 9/11 to launch the war on terror against Afghanistan and extend it to Iraq and Palestine, and from there possibly to Syria, Lebanon, and Iran, although I'm not necessarily making that prediction. So that's what happened to the objective, to Bush 1's objective. It didn't fail because of Oslo and all these things. What happened to the Iraqi people and what may be in store for others in the Arab world is a continuation of what the West has been doing to this region for at least two centuries. It is called imperialism, as many of us know. Today, a remarkable similarity can be discerned between the Middle East at present and the Middle East 80 years ago. The important question is whether the U.S. is likely to succeed in reshaping the strategic landscape in this troubled region more than did the British long time ago. Is it likely to learn any useful lessons from the British imperial adventures of the past two centuries? Judging by what has transpired so far, the answer may not be very encouraging, as long as Washington and its compliant media keep talking about an insurgency while avoiding anything to do with a nationalist resistance. That phrase is simply not there at all. Now, in real conclusion, I said before I was thinking about a conclusion. Now, the conclusion. The Bush doctrine of preventive wars has already broadened the gulf between the United States and Israel on the one hand, and much of the world which clings to the rule of law and the peaceful resolution of international disputes. You remember the advisory opinion that was issued on July 9th of this year by the International Court of Justice. I think that the advisory opinion has really underscored and emphasized this cultural political divide which we see in the world today. A divide between America and Israel on the one hand and the rest of the world on the other. The court voted 14-1 against Israel, while the General Assembly backed the court by a vote of 150-6. Who are the six? The U.S., Israel, Micronesia, Marshall Islands, and two others that I can't pronounce. And I can assure you that 99% of the American people have never heard of them. If these figures tell us anything, they certainly reveal the extent of international isolation for the U.S. and Israel, which could spawn international action to compel Israeli compliance with international law in accordance with the ICJ's ruling, similar to what happened in Namibia in the 1970s and 1980s, and to what happened in East Timor in the 1990s. The accumulated dismantlement of Palestinian rights, which make many of us discouraged, enshrined in international humanitarian law by U.S. diplomacy under the guise of the so-called peace process, would have to be rebuilt. It would have to be rebuilt, but it is not going to rebuild by the peace process or by the roadmap or by the disengagement or any of these things. It would have to be rebuilt and restored by international civil society. The governments have failed, and now I think the time is for international civil society action, pursuant to the implementation of the World Court verdict. So the burning issue, the priority now, is how to implement the advisory opinion. It is an advisory opinion, but it is very weighty and it is very prestigious, and it carries a lot of legitimacy. Are we likely to see an inevitable clash which could send shockwaves throughout the world that has grown disillusioned by U.S. disregard of the rule of law, for multilateralism, for constitutional principles of checks and balances. A renewed commitment to genuine peace based on international law and on principled compromises would have to replace the Israeli diktat shielded by U.S. naked power. The status quo would be challenged not only by defenseless Palestinian civilians, but also by a global movement that has grown tired of a militarized U.S. foreign policy driven by an outmoded moral mission and medieval religious values that defy the dominant global trends of secularism, of rationalism, and multiculturalism. Bush's claims of divine inspiration and Sharon's expansionist designs, shrouded in a misguided notion of self-defense, would be exposed for what they really are: a reincarnation of old-fashioned imperialism and settler colonialism that have become anathema to a world in search of new directions, to a world in search of new diplomacy and a reconsolidation of international law. Is it not time for America to review its priorities? Is it not time to re-examine the root causes of the present blowback? Is it not time to think seriously about how to settle a national debt of $400 billion without having to utilize other people's economies and other people's assets for the revival of U.S. economy? Is it not time to allow people all over the world to live in freedom and dignity, to organize their lives and societies in accordance with their needs, and not to suit the strategic requirements of major powers? It is certainly time to repair the U.S. inner cities, to improve health, education, public transportation, and to develop a real conservation policy instead of using war as the only conservation policy for the United States. Is it not time? Well, war really is the policy it is the policy of conservation. Is it not time for a regime change in Washington? But listen, by that I don't mean installing Kerry and dumping Bush. I mean changing the fundamentals. I mean changing the priorities, changing the imperatives of a militarized foreign policy, changing the assumptions which lead to fear and insecurity, and adopting a healthy attitude about something that is called the root cause, which is never looked at. In the final analysis, we in the United States need to stray a bit beyond the confines of the debates, the presidential debates, as they call them, consecrated by the so-called mainstream media, and there really is nothing mainstream about it anyway. We need to insist on a real debate, on a real presidential debate, that goes beyond the burning issue of which candidate makes a better manager of the empire. Because that is what the whole thing was about, really, as to who can demonstrate, stronger muscle to guard the empire. What is really needed is to determine which candidate can better dismantle the empire. For the empire is the problem, and the problem cannot be part of the solution. Not for Iraq, not for Palestine, not for the deficit, not for employment, not for health care, and not for social security. Thank you very much.